Good morning. You are listening to the local news hour here on KPCW. I'm Roger Goldman. Let's see what we got in store for our weather. Once again, it seems like spring has at least gone away a little bit. Let's see what Cedric Haynes has to say.
Happy Friday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch. Back on this Friday, welcome back to wintertime out there. We've got some frigid temperatures this morning, and it's going to stay on the cold side as we go throughout today. We do expect to see drier conditions building in after a few morning snowflakes. We should see some sunshine in the afternoon with temperatures warming up into the upper 30s in the Park City area. We'll see those highs climbing into the low 40s in the Heber Valley. These temperatures, of course, are well below average for this time of the year, so definitely make sure you are bundled up. Now, as we go into tonight with clear skies and light winds, I expect another frigid night heading our way. In fact, temperatures may be even a degree or two colder tonight as opposed to this morning out there, as we see those temperatures dipping down into the mid-teens probably across most of the Wasatch back, as temperatures will be clear with those cold conditions settling in across the region. As we go into your day on Saturday, though, we start to see a rebound as high pressure begins to build into the area. That'll bring back that sunshine and help to boost those temperatures. So we're looking at the high temperatures climbing back into the low 50s for us in Park City by your Saturday afternoon, with highs climbing near 60 in the Heber Valley. By the time we move into your Sunday, look for lots of sunshine. Again, temperatures starting off below freezing in the upper 20s, but we'll see those highs rebounding in Park City back into the mid-60s for highs, and we'll be in the low 70s for us in the Heber Valley. Next week starts off fairly quiet with a mixture of sun and clouds. We'll see those temperatures climbing into the upper 60s to near 70 in Park City. We'll see those highs in the mid-70s in the Heber Valley. So definitely a nice warming trend as we head into the weekend and next week specifically. Now, as we get towards your Wednesday, we start to track our next storm system moving in, and that has the potential of bringing more unsettled weather conditions once we get towards the middle and latter half of next week. Now, that being still several days out and the potential of a couple of low pressures moving through, that could mean some unsettled weather conditions. We'll fine-tune that forecast, but expect the chance of rain and snow to return by the time we get towards next Thursday and Friday. That's the latest on your forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up, I'll be speaking with Brenda Bushnell of the U.S. Forest Service. Then U.S. District 4 Representative Tierra Oxier is going to call in and talk to us about HB 312 and also her efforts to introduce new legislation on preliminary municipalities. We're going to finish our hour by speaking with Don Brown about the upcoming Summit and Wasatch County Wildfire Preparedness Fair. Stay tuned. The controversial proposal for a Snyderville Basin Cemetery has shed light on Summit County's plans to build a road across Kimball Junction open space. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports.
A Summit County road planned near the site where the Snyderville Basin's first public cemetery could be is drawing the ire of Bear Hollow neighbors. The route appears on draft blueprints for the graveyard and would connect Olympic Parkway with Bear Cub Drive. Bear Hollow homeowners told the Cemetery District Board at a meeting April 13th they fear the road will funnel traffic into their community. Cemetery Board members Max Greenhall and Pete Gilwald say they included the road in cemetery designs to show the cemetery doesn't conflict with Summit County's plans. It's not their proposed access point.
And if we don't have a cemetery there, the road is still
going to show up at some point.
The road is going to be there.
The road would cut south from Olympic, which curves west, to Bear Cub. It would be about 0.2 miles. The connector originates from Summit County's long-range transportation plan, which includes projects across the county through 2050. The road near Bear Hollow is on the menu in Phase 1 from 2022 to 2030. Speaking on KPCW's Local News Hour Wednesday, County Transportation Planner Carl Miller called it critical.
So that way we have full connection and we have redundancy, so if there was a crash or an incident on the Olympic Parkway heading up to Utah Olympic Park, that we would have different ways to direct traffic. We can also use this as a catalyst for how are we going to serve Olympic traffic down the road.
The short description of the concept in the long-range plan says the road would, quote, help alleviate congestion on Ute Boulevard and Olympic Parkway as they connect onto 224. But Bear Hollow residents don't want to become a cut-through for commuters or skiers like Old Ranch Road. Resident Sandra Vandergriff, who called herself, quote, cemetery girl, told the board that the traffic is an everyday problem.
But the number one upshot is we're still against it at this location. One, by putting the cemetery in on 224 and that access, you've now made it a straight thoroughfare from Kilby Road all the way to Bear Cove.
According to Gilwald, Summit County is planning to commission a comprehensive study of Kimball Junction traffic. Residents have called for a holistic approach as they've watched proposals from Dakota Pacific Real Estate. Utah Olympic Park and Junction Commons processed piecemeal with isolated traffic studies. The Cemetery District is offering to fund its part of the traffic study if that means it gets done sooner. Before any road connects Olympic and Bear Cub, Miller says the county will study the impacts to neighbors and the environment. He added that just because a project is on the long-range plan doesn't mean it'll happen soon or at all, since there's limited money to go around. The county will update the long-range plan this year and reissue it in 2027, incorporating public input. Cemetery board member Pete Gilwald is the play-by-play announcer for Park City High School football games on KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, Utah is the number one state in the nation for economic outlook for the 19th year in a row. That distinction is made in rich states, poor states. A report on economic competitiveness from the Conservative American Legislative Exchange Council. The report evaluates forward-looking policies to determine whether where opportunity is most likely to grow, and for almost two decades, Utah has been the leading example. The Beehive State is first in the nation in adjusted median household income growth, increasing by nearly 80% since 1970. The state's economic strength is also reinforced across multiple national rankings, including number one in gross domestic product growth and for upward mobility 2 years in a row. Utah Governor Spencer Cox said his office is focused on keeping Utah a place where families can succeed, businesses can grow, and the next generation has every opportunity to build a strong future. In the overall 2026 economic growth ranking, Tennessee ranked number two and Idaho was third. Growth in Wasatch County may be slowing down, but it's still outpacing the rest of Utah. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has a snapshot of the county's planned development.
State data shows Wasatch County is in for some significant demographic shifts.
Since about the turn of the century, we were averaging about 4 to 6%, which is an extremely high growth rate. Kempsey Gardner's projections are showing that slowing down to around 2% for the next 30 years. At that 2% growth rate, you're still looking at about double what the state average is.
That's Wasatch County Planner Austin Corey speaking at an interlocal meeting Wednesday, where leaders from across the Heber Valley discussed how they're planning for the future. Corey says the median age will change too, from 35 years old to almost 50 over the next three decades. With the rapidly changing community in mind, he says the county is revising its land use policies as part of a general plan update.
The last comprehensive general plan was done in 2001. So it was before the Olympics. It was before the Jordan Hill Parkway was built. It was before MIDA came to town and before COVID-19.
He says the guidelines are meant to prevent sprawl, protect open space, and ensure developed land is used appropriately. He also stressed the importance of regional collaboration, such as ensuring transportation infrastructure serves residents of all incomes and lifestyles. Heber City's Community Development Director, Tony Kohler, shared a closer look at how many homes are planned for construction.
A lot of our growth is going to be centered in the North Village area along North Highway 40. We're going to see a lot of changes in the coming decade.
Several thousand homes are planned for the Jordan L. Ridge development, although Kohler says the total number will be smaller than the 5,700 units originally proposed. In Midway, development is a very different story. Planning Director Michael Hinke says the number of land use applications is dropping because little land is available. The town has also prioritized open space preservation.
Yeah, we have talked about expanding our annexation declaration even into North Fields. And part of that is so we can use our open space bond funds to help preserve those areas, not necessarily that they would actually develop.
At 1,200 square miles, Wasatch County has more land than the state of Rhode Island. Corey says nearly 70% of that land is controlled by the state or federal government, and about 7% is part of a city or town. The rest is unincorporated county land. A draft of Wasatch County's new land use plan is expected later this spring. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Notwithstanding the brief spell of wintry weather that's so evident outside the window this morning, it is indeed spring, and time to think about warm weather recreation. On the phone, we have U.S. Forest Service Camas District spokesman, Brenda Bushnell. Good morning, Brenda. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
So, Brenda, let's get a size. I was curious as we were getting ready for this interview about the sort of the size of the national forest land in the Camas District. How much land do you have and where is it located?
So we cover quite a bit of area on our district. We have roughly about 500,000 acres that we cover from the Weber Canyon that heads up towards Smith and Morehouse and out towards the area past the Strawberry Reservoir.
And are there different names attached to each of them? I'm just trying to understand how sort of our listeners could identify where these areas are easily.
Probably demographic. Mm-hmm. We cover the Mirror Lake Highway, which is State Route 150. Mm-hmm. We cover along Highway 35, mm-hmm. and then along Highway 40 as well.
Okay. And just to remind our listeners about the difference between national parks and national forests.
Well, that's kind of interesting. National parks actually fall under the Department of Interior, mm-hmm. and the national forests fall under the Department of Agriculture. So we have a little bit of difference there. There is different rules and regulations that apply to both of those areas as well.
Okay. My sense was always that the national forests had a little more flexibility and a little more sort of, user range, if you will, than national
yes.
parks.
Yes.
Okay. So let's talk about some of the trail and camping areas within the national forest within our districts. Where are some of those available?
Right now, where snow is melting off, we have a little bit of area that is accessible to recreate on, but we want to remind users that we're still in spring conditions. We still have a lot of snow in some areas and a lot of mud and water in other areas. So just being smart when they are, because I know the sun's been shining, we've had some nice weather, it's getting warmer down in the valley, so everybody wants to come out and recreate, and we're not quite there yet, but we're getting closer.
And are there sort of trail maps? Where can people find information about what's accessible to them within the district?
Your best bet is to give our office a call and talk to us personally. I mean, sometimes the internet's great, but it doesn't have up-to-date conditions. So a call to one of our offices is a good resource.
And once the summer sits in full swing, are there sort of both availability of sort of backcountry camping and also are there designated campgrounds?
Yes, there are. We do have designated campgrounds, which will start opening here in the next month. And then there is dispersed camping that's allowed in some places, but you still want to make sure that the area that you're in is a dispersed area and not creating a new one. And we do have a lot of places where you can camp outside of the developed campground or inside a developed campground.
And again, the best way to get that information is the weather issue is why you need to talk to the office. Is there other information on the internet that would help me figure out where I could go?
We have a lot of info on our Forest Service webpage, and then a lot of the developed campgrounds are on recreation.gov, which is a contractor that is a private concessionaire with the Forest Service that runs and operates the campground, and then reservations are dealt through recreation.gov, and that's a place where you would go to make the reservations if you wanted to stay in the developed campgrounds. And the majority of our campgrounds anymore are strictly reservations, and those can be made up to 4 months in advance. There are still a couple campgrounds that are first come, first served, though. But those resources give some good information on the area.
And again, just to give our listeners a sense, how many campgrounds are there that you can make reservations for?
Oh, sure, you're going to test my brain.
It's Friday morning. I wouldn't do this to you
on
a Monday. I wouldn't do this to you on a Monday.
On our district, we have probably about 25
and
different campgrounds.
And are some of them adjacent to other kinds of recreation, like lakes or other kinds of things that you can do?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. We have a lot that are on lakes, next to hiking trails. We offer a lot of recreation in and around our area of our district.
I know one of the things that I think you wanted to talk about was this concept of responsible recreation. What does that term mean to you?
You know, we want people to treat the forest with respect and keeping a clean campsite, packing out your trash and everything that you brought with you, disposing of waste properly. A big one is staying on the designated routes and not making a new road. And then being considerate of other visitors. We have a lot of recreationists that visit the forest. And so just taking that into respect.
And I guess one of the elements of respect is this notion of, particularly in the undeveloped areas, of bringing out what you bring in. In other words, taking out trash.
Correct.
Is that a problem? I mean, do you find that some of our users are not considerate of the land?
It is a huge issue. We have a lot of places where people will even just go and dump their trash. We had one area just here within the last couple of weeks that they had taken a lawnmower and started it on fire. So being considerate of the National Forest, that we have a lot of visitors, and just keeping in the back of your mind, would you want to come camping and see all of the trash? Pack it in, pack it out is a good old saying that, you know, if you bring it in, take it home with you.
Now, you mentioned someone setting a lawnmower on fire. That is not exactly what I would think of as enjoyable recreation, but it does sort of bring up an issue I wanted to ask you about, which is we don't have much of a snowpack this year, and I think that we're looking at a pretty dry summer. How do you think that that's going to affect recreation this summer, and do you anticipate we might have to have some new restrictions?
Correct. We did have a very low snowpack, and we are looking that we are going to be pretty dry. And so the first thing is having recreationists be smart with their campfires, being smart where you put it and how big you make it. And the biggest thing is making sure it's completely extinguished before you leave, to the point that if you put your hand down there, you cannot feel heat. The fire outlook, we could have some big fires. Hopefully we keep receiving a little bit more moisture here now and then, like we did over the night. But being responsible and helping us prevent that, and just, I can't stress enough, is make sure it's completely out before you leave.
And again, are you engaging in sort of wildfire preparation exercises with some of the fire departments? Is that something that you at the National Forest do?
We have meetings and discuss and are on the same page, but per se, we're all in it together. And yep. So, yes, we do have conversations, and we are all gearing up for what we might think would be a pretty good fire season. So,
or pretty bad, as the case may be. So I want to know before you go about the Know Before You Go program.
So Know Before You Go is just kind of what we've talked about all along, is giving us a call, making sure you have a plan for your trip, making sure things are open, conditions are good to camp, and then having an alternate plan in case they're not. Especially with springtime, we do have some mid-elevation gates that may be closed that you may not be able to access an area due to the fact that we still have runoff, and we don't want users creating resource damage because the roads are muddy. So there's stuff like that where, you know, give us a call. Call the office and ask some questions and make sure that where you're thinking about going is open and available. And a lot of our calls right now, they want to go fishing, they want to go hiking, and it's like, well, we still have snow and the lakes are still frozen. So give us a call.
Okay, and that number is?
The CAMAS office number is 435-783-4338.
Okay, Brenda Bushnell, who is the U.S. Forest Service CAMAS District spokesperson. Brenda, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Tierra Oxia represents the 4th House District in the Utah Legislature, a district that includes part of Summit County. She joins us by phone to talk about the HB 312 legislation she sponsored and about her efforts with respect to preliminary municipalities. Good morning, Representative Oxia, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Roger. I'm glad to be here.
So before we get to HB 312, I wonder if we just spend a little bit of time talking about your background and the path that led you to seek a legislative office.
Yeah, thank you. I'm just finishing up my first term as a legislator. I took over for Kira Berkland when she resigned. And, you know, it was kind of a surprise to me that I actually wanted to throw my hat at the race for this. But I've been involved in my school community councils for many, many years in the different areas where I've lived. And there were a lot of things that we would just talk about and discuss in either our community councils at the school or at the district community council. And many times I would find myself asking, why are we doing this? And the schools would come back and say, oh, it's not us. You know, this is coming down from the state. And so when I would talk to my husband about different frustrations, he would say, well, maybe you need to go to the state. And so that had been kind of rolling around in my brain for a little bit. And so when Kira Berkland resigned, I decided that I was going to have all these opinions and ideas, then maybe I should try and make some change at the state level. And so I decided to throw my hat in the ring for that. I'm a tax accountant by profession, and so financial transparency and accountability is really important to me. You know, I care a lot about taxes, and that's really top of mind for so many of my constituents right now. I represent Morgan Rich and most of Summit County. And so, you know, I see a wide range of people, and that's always really high up there on the priorities that they mention. And I just, you know, I have a great interest in our government and our country, and wanted to do what I could in public service.
And have you found that first term to be rewarding?
Yes, it's very rewarding. I feel like I've been able to be effective and pass some legislation, especially in my first term, that many people told me there was no way I'd be able to pass. And I'm happy to talk about that later. But one of them specifically was a property tax relief bill of an automatic tax increase that I found. And that wasn't going through truth and taxation like every single property tax we have besides that one. And I just believe we need some transparency when the government wants to take our money.
Well, we're going to come. I want to get to some other things, but I can't leave that one there. Can you explain that one a little bit more, just so people understand the legislation?
Yeah, sure. So it's HB 110 from the 2025 session. And basically, every time we increased property taxes for the schools, it would automatically bump up this other tax. And in over 5 years, it had grown to $200 million and was compounding by $30 million at least a year, and would have continued to go on indefinitely had I not passed that legislation to get rid of that. And so I just strongly believe that when government wants to take our money, they need to justify why they want to take it and be open about it. And so that we have a process called Truth in Taxation where, you know, we are informed that different governing bodies want to increase our taxes, and then we have the ability to give public comment. But that was not happening in this situation.
So when I look at that property tax bill, and there's all those like 25 lines, what would happen before if the school tax went up, automatically one of those other lines would get affected without a truth in taxation?
Yes.
Okay. What was the other line? Just out of curiosity.
So it's called the guaranteed rate. Okay. So basically every school district is able to get a guaranteed amount of money up to 20 increments. And it's kind of confusing, but let's say our tax code, I think, is very confusing on purpose. So it is hard to understand. But this is part of the way that we guarantee that every kid gets the same education across the state. And so every school district has to tax a certain amount. And if that rate goes up, that's where, you know, this other value rate was that was being automatically increased. But if they don't get to that 20 increment by just their own taxation, then the state guarantees to make up to that 20 increments. And so it's part of that every time we're like raising the rate of what the school districts are levying on their citizens. But then this was like a special thing off to the side that was connected to it, but didn't have to do with how much they were actually being given back from the state.
And so now we'll have a separate truth in taxation associated with that kind of an incremental change.
Yeah, I mean, it would just be the same truth in taxation as everything else,
but it is subject to that
same meeting. Yeah. Okay. Yes, it is.
So we talked about, we've already gotten to education. So let's talk about HB 312. Why did you sponsor the legislation? What were you out to accomplish?
Yeah, so I'm really kind of excited to be able to talk about this. I know some people have seen some headlines, and like anything, headlines are made to be very clickbaity, and most people aren't actually reading the full bill. So House Bill 312 is really just about strengthening civics education. and really getting the students engaged deeply with America's founding documents and the ideas that shaped them, which also includes allowing educators to reference historically influential texts like portions of the Bible, strictly for their impact on literature and language and political thought. So it's not about teaching religion. I've heard a lot about people saying, oh, they already have seminary classes or you can go teach Bible classes. This isn't about a Bible class. It's about teaching history accurately and giving students the context they need to understand our founding. And then some of the other things in there that I think are really cool is it encourages using the spiral instruction method, which lets them revisit across grade levels and integrate across different subjects. And so what this bill talks about is what historical influences can be studied, not necessarily what they must believe. And so, you know, why would I sponsor legislation like this? And it's about civic literacy. I hear from so many parents and teachers and grandparents that students are graduating without a strong understanding of the principles behind the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. And in fact, it was such a big problem this year that so many of us in the legislature hear about that this past session, there were multiple bills about civics and social studies. And this bill, 312, is actually a combination of three different bills by three different representatives. And we just tried to work together to get it into one bill. Just, you know, we pass a lot of bills, so it's easier if we can, if it's the same subject matter, to try to combine them. And so in this bill, there's lots of other things. And so adding the Bible to what sources can be studied is just a small portion of the bill, but it's one that's being really focused on. But all it did was add it to sources like the Declaration of Independence or the Mayflower Compact or Magna Carta, Supreme Court decisions, et cetera, of things we can study as the influence for the founding. And so, you know, if the students are going to be understanding documents like the Declaration of Independence, they need to understand the ideas behind them. The founders didn't operate in a vacuum. You know, they were influenced by a range of sources, including Enlightenment thinkers, but also by this shared cultural vocabulary that included biblical language and themes that were widely understood at the time. In fact, this is already used in higher education. You know, this is a standard thing to study the great books of Western civilization, which includes the Bible alongside works like Plato and John Locke. And it's not because the students are being told to believe those texts, but because they shaped our civilization. So the goal is really just to give our students a more complete understanding of American history and making sure that we're teaching foundational documents with the context they actually came in.
So I guess the way you would respond to people who say this is effectively mandating the teaching of religion is what? What would you say to that? Someone says, hey, wait, you know, you are explicitly sort of pulling the Bible into the curriculum. And how do I avoid having that turning into teaching theology or doctrine?
Yeah, you know, I would just say that that is not accurate. And I would love the people to actually go and read the bill, because the bill does not require religious instruction, prayer, or belief of any kind. In fact, there's a clear constitutional line that teaching religion in a devotional way is not allowed. But teaching about religion academically is not only allowed, it's already standard in most universities and several public schools across the country. So this bill stays firmly on the academic side of that line. It's about historical influence and not religious practice. So, you know, like I said, students are being asked what to believe. They're being taught about what influenced the founders. So this bill really follows that same approach to using the Great Books programs, mm-hmm. Which I talked about earlier, which have been a part of a liberal arts education from the very beginning. So students might read the Bible the same way they read the Republic, you know, to mm-hmm. understand the influence, not necessarily to adopt the belief. So, you know, this isn't mandating religion. It's preventing incomplete history. They're just being given the tools to understand the ideas that shaped their country.
Do you have any concern about the way it affects the balance between state and local control of curriculum?
No, I don't. And I would say the reason why that is I'll give you an example. George Washington, who's one of my heroes, talked to Congress one time, and he spoke about the reason why we should fund education as a government in the aim of helping our citizens and the assimilation of the principles and opinions of our countrymen, is what he called it, by the common education of our youth. And he said that, you know, the primary object in educating our youth was in the science of government, and said that in a republic, what species of knowledge can be equally important, and what duty more pressing on the legislature than to patronize a plan for communicating that to those who are to be the future guardians of the liberties of the country. So, you know, how I would ask, how can we expect our citizens to defend those liberties if they don't understand where they came from? So it's our responsibility as a legislature to make sure that our students do. So this bill strikes a balance. The state has a legitimate role in setting core standards. You know, the school board is in charge of setting those standards, especially around civics and foundational knowledge. That ensures every student, no matter where they live, gets the same understanding of our system of government. But at the same time, local school districts and teachers determine how to teach that material. So they retain flexibility in their lesson plans and text and classroom approach. So really, at the state, we're setting expectations for what students should understand, while also preserving local control over how it's taught.
The bill, you mentioned that the bill represents a number of different different sort of potential bills run together. And I actually did read, I think I read all of it last night. It took me a while. But there was one provision that caught my eye as I was reading it, and that was it mandates the teaching of the benefits of the Electoral College. Now, a lot of people argue that the Electoral College is anti-democratic. Why wouldn't the bill have mandated that issue, among others, could be explored on both sides?
Well, you know, the reason why is because it talks about teaching the form of government that we have right now. And and so if we talk about why our founding fathers made the government the way they wanted to, we have to understand why. And so obviously they thought that was a benefit, and that is how it still is today. And so we're studying, you know, history and social studies in that context of, okay, what is our system of government today? You know, could that conversation be part of another class at some time? Yes, but our duty as a legislature is to make sure that they are understanding the government that we have today.
I take it that there's nothing that wouldn't prevent teachers who are exploring that to explain why other people might feel differently. In other words, just because it says to teach the benefits, I assume that doesn't mean you can't teach what some of the criticisms are as well.
Yeah, you know, as, like we said, the curriculum is open for the teachers to be able to decide how to do that. Yep. So, I don't think that there would be a problem. I mean, especially these are some of the ideas that historically when people would come to college, that these are ideas where they would question and push back against things, and that's how you learn. So
I want to talk about preliminary municipalities. And, you know, when you and I talked briefly yesterday, and I told you I was interested in local land use control, you said, you mean preliminary municipalities, and I did. But let's sort of help our listeners with a little background. What are preliminary municipalities?
Yeah, so in 2023, there was a bill that was passed. So this is a new thing. And basically, it allows three or less private property holders, which are almost always developers and have been developers in every single case so far, to be able to go to this lieutenant governor and ask to become a city outside of any sort of working with the county and there's local zoning. And so the lieutenant governor would then do commission a feasibility study to say, like, is this actually feasible for this to work? And there are two of these that can be approved every year. Now, there's people out there trying to expand how many of these will be accepted every year and approved every year. But it's definitely a way to force state overreach on zoning onto counties that, you know, would have a different say in things. And in fact, in a few of these developments which have applied to be cities with the lieutenant governor, they already had plans approved by the counties that they were going to build in. And yet they still went to the lieutenant governors because they know then they could rewrite the zoning and do whatever they wanted outside of whatever the community wanted. In fact, in Summit County, I'm sure so many are aware of the Dakota Pacific development. And I went and talked to the lieutenant governor many times because I knew the referendum was happening against it, and was told that even if the referendum had passed, there was nothing that would make it so that they would not approve that at the state level, and that development would continue to be able to happen no matter what the citizens thought. And I just think that is a gross overreach of power and not respectful to the voters and taxpayers in that community.
You know, the cynic in me thinks that this legislation simply enables large developers to sort of rip land use control out of the hands of the local government. And I guess I wonder, what was the justification for? Why do people think this legislation, this idea of allowing sort of private developers to create towns that they're probably not going to permanently run anyway? What do people say is the reason that it was a good idea in the first place?
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. Like, they're not interested in being their own city. After the next breath of, we want our own city and we want to be able to do this and we're private property owners, we should be able to do what we want with our land, yet we want to just annex into the closest city after we're done.
And get them, like, to supply our fire and our sewers and our police, right? Right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's no thought into how that's going to affect the existing infrastructure. But where the idea came from is there was a developer who was trying to develop down in Moab, and they had been working with the county council down there for, you know, numerous years and couldn't get going on what they wanted to do. And technically, they were entitled to actually be able to develop the land that they had. So they weren't necessarily looking to change existing zoning, but just couldn't get it through the county council. And because of that, and they came to the state and the different relationships that there are up there and forced this bill through. And, you know, I'm not going to get into whether they had a justification for that one development or not. I think there's other ways to get around things if you're entitled to them. You know, you probably could have sued or something else about it, but to then make a law which would affect the entire state and open up this avenue to all developers in all counties, I don't think that was the right way to go about that.
And what would the legislation have done that you wanted to get through?
Yeah, so I was running HB 510 this past session, and the session before, a representative and I actually tried to get rid of this process altogether. And when that didn't work, I came back and I had multiple discussions with, all the different interested groups and tried to really come to some agreement on what it could look like, because there was a lot of questions about, okay, say this city failed, who would actually end up holding the bag on that? And it was the taxpayers of the county. It wasn't the developers. And so I wanted to really make sure that the money that was set aside to pay for that infrastructure for those cities would be there to continue that, even if a developer went bankrupt. It would also have let the counties have more of an input from the very beginning. In fact, when the lieutenant governor is contracting to do these feasibility studies, if you looked at some of the feasibility studies in the current law, it talks about basing those off of the services that are already there. But if this is undeveloped land, there's no services there. So when they're trying to say how much a police force is going to be, some of these said they could do a whole force for less than what it costs for one deputy in the same county. And so obviously they're not using real numbers. And I wanted them to be able to get numbers from the county and the county to be able to submit things and say, hey, we just had another development come in and this is what it costs to actually lay down some of these roads. Or, you know, this is what it's going to look like to put in some of this infrastructure. And so it would have allowed them to also do that. And then it would make them, these developers have to go to the county and try a good faith effort to come up with a planning agreement with them first before going to the state, and just using that more as a last resort. Because that's what I kept hearing, like, this is the last resort. No one would actually want to do this. And, you know, if that's true, then why do we have so many people applying every single year for this? You know, like there's a reason why they want it and want to step over the counties and go around the voters and taxpayers. And I think there needs to be more accountability and respect to the people in those communities.
Are you going to give it another go next year?
Yeah, I think this is a subject I'll try to stay on for quite a while. I mean, there's a lot of headwinds coming the other way of people who wanting, you know, to kind of open the door to whatever, because we're focused on building everywhere we can, it sounds like. And so I just don't think that this is the way to do it. I think there needs to be more local control. I mean, we argue all the time about the federal government coming in and taking over so much of our land and other things, and it's the same with the state. And so I'm one who believes in limited government.
Okay. Representative Tierra Oxier of the 4th District, thanks so much for spending time with us this morning. Hope you'll come back again.
Thanks so much. Have a good day.
Wildfires continue to be a challenge in our area and throughout the West, and somehow I think the lack of snowpack could make this summer a doozy. There are many things you can do to help prepare for wildfire. And tomorrow, I guess the second annual Wildfire Preparedness Fair for Summit and Wasatch County will take place at Ecker Hill Middle School. Here to talk about it is Don Brown. Morning, Don.
Good morning, Roger.
There we go. So, Don, I say it's the second annual, but it really is. There's been more than two. This relates back to something you started a number of years ago, doesn't
Indeed.
It?
Indeed. Pine Brook has been offering these fairs, it started 5 years ago. We had three, and then Glenwild approached us with interest in a shared event. That was last year, and then this year we've expanded to now a dozen HOAs in Wasatch and Summit County.
And, okay, why do you do this? Well, what is the purpose of the exercise?
Well, we live in a wildfire regime, if you will. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. The Parleys Canyon fire is a great example of that. And living in the WUI, the wildland-urban interface, necessitates that we prepare ourselves for the eventuality of wildfire. And we want to educate the homeowners of the area so that they can have that preparedness.
And let's talk a little bit about what the day will be like. How will it unfold tomorrow? And this is, well, let's stop and do our sort of promotion. It's tomorrow?
No, actually, it's the 25th.
Okay, so I'm off by a week. The 25th, and where will it be held?
Ecker Hill Middle School.
And
we have the auditorium and the foyer, so tables will be set up, and we'll use the auditorium for our panel discussion.
And the hours are from 10 to 2?
They are.
Okay.
Yep, it's a good part of the day.
Okay, so I come in there at 10 o'clock. What's going to happen first?
Well, you'll see the tables arranged. We're going to have a couple dozen experts, vendors, governmental entities available for the public to browse and gather information and network. And then at 10:30, they'll be able to attend the panel discussion, which will run until noon. That should then enervate, engage, and raise the interest of the attendees such that they can come out from 12 to 2 and further gather information that they seek.
So let's talk a little bit about the panel. It looks like to me like you've impressed, they've put together a pretty impressive group. Talk to us a little bit about who they are and why you think their message is relevant.
Yeah, we're really excited. The group, it's six local experts. We'll have Brad Washaw from Utah State University. He's been instrumental in a lot of the successes we've had in our wildfire fuels mitigation work. He'll speak to the wildfire and nature and our relationship to wildfire. Then we're going to have Fielding Norton. He's the managing director of the Wilkes Center at University of Utah. He'll bring experience with the science as well as insurance. That'll be an interesting perspective. David Tellian, co-owner of Alpine Forestry, he'll bring some practical knowledge relating to what can be done to mitigate wildfire risk. Tiger Rohrer. He's with the Forestry, Fire, and State Lands, Utah agency. They're responsible for realizing the House Bill 48 mandates. He'll be able to speak to that. Paul Borup, he's president of Century West Insurance Services. He'll be able to bring a very pragmatic perspective on insurance as it relates to wildfire risk and what homeowners should know. And then lastly, our fire chief, Park City Fire District, Pete Emery, will be present to offer his insights.
I want to take a slight detour because the insurance issue in particular, it seems to me, is driving a lot of this discussion. And are we still seeing, obviously we're seeing increased rates. Are we seeing problems with even availability of insurance because of this wildfire risk?
There are anecdotes of people losing insurance, of people not being able to get coverage. It's certainly part of what House Bill 48 is intended to address, at least offer homeowners some protections. I'll let the panelists speak in more detail to that next Saturday. But indeed, we want to inform the homeowners and give them the best understanding of the situation so that they can take the action they feel they need to.
And I've heard the term hardening before, relating to individual homes. And people hear that and they go, yeah, do I really have to do that stuff? Does it really make a difference? Mm. And I take it that some of these people will be able to address that issue in particular.
They will be given information about what it means to ready your property for a wildfire. It starts as far as 100 feet away from your home. You make some decisions about what you plant and maybe what plants you might remove, and then it comes up as close to 5 feet from the house. Maybe you don't have any combustible materials.
That lovely wood mulch that we all like to have is
indeed,
probably not a good idea.
Replace it with rock.
Yeah.
Or bare earth. The idea of hardening, though, the house itself can accumulate embers from a fire. Embers are a major cause of loss of homes in wildfires. The embers can be cast a mile or more, and when they nestle in a pile of pine needles in your roof, or they get into a soffit and nestle in the insulation, they can smolder and create fire. So hardening might be as simple as putting some screening up to prevent that ember from getting to those flammable elements of the home.
You know, it's funny, I happened to be in Pacific Palisades last week, and I was being driven through the neighborhood, and you'll see all these burned out lots still, or lots that are in there, and then you come upon a completely intact home. And you'd ask, why is that? And what the person I was with said, oh, because they had done all these steps. Mm-hmm. So I basically, to see that vivid a representation of the effects of hardening certainly opened my eyes a bit.
Wonderful. And we're going to hear some stories, I'm confident. And again, the experts that we'll have available can offer their thoughts and perhaps even immediate direction.
And again, one of the things I've heard, in addition to sort of stories about mulch, which you know I didn't really focus on until I heard this, is this importance of removing trees close to the home. Why is that so important?
Well, the tree is a source of ignition, of fuel, and it will create radiant heat, and it could then catch the home on fire. It stands to reason if you want to minimize your risk, you won't have things that are combustible next to your home. But you can make decisions that moderate the risk. If it's an evergreen tree, well, trim it back from the house. Mm-hmm. It's going to drop needles. Clean those needles up. Don't let them accumulate. If it's an aspen tree, well, it's a very wet and green tree, and you know it. It might not be as great a risk. The idea is to lessen the fuel load around your home and give fire the least opportunity to approach your structure.
How'd you come to learn about all this? What sort of motivated you to get into it?
Well, it was involvement with the Pine Brook Master Association Board, and our neighborhood had an awareness of a lot of dead and dying evergreen trees There was this horrible aesthetic issue. And so we created the Dead Tree Task Force to address the issue. First blush, it was going to be cut them down and get rid of them. But then we understood that they were dying because of a beetle problem. Yeah. And it's prevalent in Utah. And we became aware of fire risk associated with this fuel load, these dead trees. And so what began as an aesthetic issue turned into an understanding that we, Pinebrook in particular, with 600 acres of open space, have a responsibility to be stewards of that open space and protect it.
Wildflower Preparedness Week, Preparedness Fair is next Saturday at Ecker Hill at April 25th. Dan, thanks for joining me this morning.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
We'll be right back after this. You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. I'm Roger Goldman. Stay tuned. Coming up, we'll have the community campfire. This week, we're going to hear how one Park City High student is going all out for Teacher Appreciation Week, showing just how much educators matter. Bill will have the skinny on sports, his conversation with the Miners' new head football coach, Coach G, and the Music Sesh is a special rebroadcast of Claire Wiley's conversation with the soulful and powerful Ron Artis II.